All right, so Joshua Taylor, welcome to Preferred Company with Joel and Marianne. Now, you're with us today with a very, very serious matter. What to do if someone suspects elder abuse? First, define elder abuse, and where is elder abuse found?
Sure. So to give you a little bit of background about myself, I'm an attorney that specializes in these issues. And what I can tell you is, by and large, the type of elder abuse that we see tends to be financial elder abuse, right? So elder abuse can be differentiated between physical elder abuse and mm-hmm. financial elder abuse. Physical elder abuse is really, you know, what you think of as physical abuse. It's, actual physical abuse. It can be neglect, maybe when an elder can't take care of themselves and their caregiver simply doesn't do their job. But what we tend to see in our office, I would say, 80-90% of the time, is this financial elder abuse.
Okay.
And that is when somebody, essentially steals an elder's assets, either because the elder has diminished capacity in some way, maybe they have dementia, and they're losing the ability to manage their own assets, or for some other reason, they're tricked into essentially giving away their assets. But the stealing of an elder's assets is really the most prevalent issue of elder abuse that we see in our office.
So how does one, let's say an elder is being abused financially. Now, obviously, somebody's got to be the first to recognize it. Who would be, if you're taking care of this person, obviously, you're the one that's in charge of the financial matters. So how does one find out if that elder is absolutely being abused or not? Like, who reports it?
That's a really good question. And, unfortunately, a lot of times the perpetrator of the abuse is actually the caregiver themselves.
Right.
It's terrible, but that's really what ends up happening. So there are a couple threshold questions to ask when facing the situation, right? The first, and this sounds kind of obvious, but is the victim of the abuse alive or not alive? Because the remedies really change depending upon whether the person is alive or dead. And most cases of abuse that we find out about, we don't find out about until after the victim has already passed away. And typically that happens when the relatives are starting to comb through the accounts and settling the estate, and they come across maybe a lot of withdrawals from a bank account or transfers of assets or things that look very suspicious, but that actually weren't discovered during this person's life and not until the person has died. So, the majority of cases really aren't uncovered until after the person passes away. But if somebody is still alive and you start to notice, unauthorized withdrawals from their bank accounts or things like that, if somebody's actually monitoring the accounts, that's the first thing to look for. But something else to ask is, who's legally in charge of managing this person's affairs, right? Because you mentioned a caregiver. And so let's talk about a couple of different definitions here, right? There's something called a power of attorney, which is somebody who has the legal authority to make financial decisions on behalf of somebody else. There's also somebody called a trustee. So if somebody has their assets in a trust, this trustee can be the person to manage their assets. There's also somebody called a conservator, which I can get into in more detail if you'd like, but that's actually a really good person to have to be managing this person's assets to prevent cases of elder abuse.
Joel, now this
Joshua,
is...
Joshua, this is Joel.
I was just going to say, Joel, with your... Hold on, wait a second. I don't mean to interrupt, but I am interrupting. Joel runs CEO of Preferred Home Healthcare and Nursing Services, which does take care of a lot of people who are dependent. Joel, have you ever come across this with Preferred Home Healthcare? Elder abuse
many times. It is a very big problem in Ocean and Monmouth counties, particularly Ocean County, given the population of people over 65. And with people living, that we are taking care of, and I could say her name because I have permission to, Helen Turner, mm-hmm. who may be 107 now. That as age increases, I would think the chance of abuse increasing proportionately with the person aging. Josh, is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we're seeing, you know, the baby boomer population is starting to retire, and we're seeing this, you know, people are living longer, and, you know, even though they're physically living longer, their mental faculties are not necessarily keeping up with, you know, with their age. And so we are seeing a lot of cases of people with dementia, you know, in various forms being taken advantage of. That's really the most common scenario that we see.
What about the gray area, Joshua? I know I've seen it. I'm sure many of our listener friends have seen it, and clearly you've seen it. When I say gray area, I'm talking about a scenario such as a daughter coming to her mother and sweet-talking her in, I'm thinking of two possible scenarios. One where she says, you know, Mom, you don't really need money anymore, and my kids, there's no money for education. I think at this point, I should have the money that you don't need any longer. And she manages to get her mother's signature into moving all of her assets into her name. Have you ever seen that?
Sure. And, you know, I can give you an interesting example. So, I had a case last year that went to trial, and we were successful at trial, where we had a mother and two adult children, a daughter and a son. We represented the son, and the daughter was on the opposing side. And the daughter was actually, you know, she lived with the mother. She was the live-in caregiver. She, you know, sacrificed her career and spent a lot of time taking care of the mother, et cetera. On the mother's deathbed, while the mother was in the ICU unit in the hospital, the mother had no estate plan. And so, you know, under California law and under most jurisdictions, her assets would have gone equally to both the daughter and the son. The mother had no estate plan, had severely diminished capacity at the end of her life. And literally 3 days before she died, the daughter got the mother to execute a new trust, giving everything to the daughter and disinheriting the son. And we were eventually successful at trial to invalidate that trust because the mother didn't have the ability to understand what she was doing. Now, whether it was fair or not, whether, you know, given the daughter's time and taking care of the mother, that should have been compensated, that's really not the issue. The issue is whether or not the person making these decisions understands what they're doing and is making them of their own free will. So if they are, you know, just like you or I, you know, we can make bad decisions, or we can, you know, make decisions people might disagree with. But as long as we understand the decisions, we understand the ramifications of the decisions, that's okay under the law. What's not okay is when somebody who doesn't understand what they're doing is being manipulated by somebody else. So that's sort of the gray area as I see it.
Joshua, what about first of all, I want to remind the audience that we're speaking to Joshua Taylor, an attorney who is also an expert in elder abuse. Joshua, I wanted to ask you this. Sadly, besides these financial manipulations that we've been talking about this morning, what about the spouse or child that may be physically abusing the elderly person in the home?
Sure. So, you know, the first thing to look at is, you know, maybe when you visit a relative, or when people that you know visit a relative and communicate those visits to you, how does the person look? Do they look as if they're well fed? Do they look as if they are, you know, properly being assisted? So just sort of the common sense things. What do you see? Do you see any red flags or any causes for concern? You know, the things that we see the most on the physical side are things like, you know, failure to properly feed or provide food for somebody that somebody's caring for, failure to properly assist them to the bathroom. Unfortunately, we see a lot of instances of that where people are, you know, who are unable to use the bathroom on their own are left to fend for themselves. So, you know, sort of the common sense approach and just checking in with people on a regular basis is the first step. If you suspect something, if you think something is amiss, my recommendation, the first thing to do would be to call Adult Protective Services and to file a complaint. That's an agency that's in place specifically to investigate instances of physical abuse. And, you know, they take it very seriously, and they will send an investigator out to the home or to the care facility, wherever this person's located, and do a full investigation. And if it looks like there is a problem, you know, they will then take the responsibility from there on out and coordinate with the authorities and take all appropriate action. So really, you don't have to be responsible other than just, you know, that initial, you know, noticing that something might be amiss. If you suspect physical abuse after death, and I've actually had a few cases involving that, where we've had relatives learn of instances of physical abuse after their loved ones have passed away, then, you know, in the context of probate litigation, you can bring claims against, you know, the abusers in civil court and probate court to remedy those abuses. So, you know, you do have private remedies for that. But I think the starting point when somebody's alive, because this is sort of the converse. Typically, we see physical abuse while somebody's still alive, and the starting point is to go directly to Adult Protective Services.
So, first of all, Joshua, where are you located?
So, our office is in Los Angeles. We're actually one of the largest probate specializing law firms in Los Angeles. We're opening a second office in San Francisco in July. And so we're very excited about that. But right now we're just located in California.
Joshua, I have seen stories within our agency, which once again is called Preferred Home Healthcare and Nursing Services. I've seen stories where the wife becomes combative because of Alzheimer's disease, as one example, and the husband may be defending himself, and it may look like elder abuse. What do you do for a couple such as that who are really both suffering?
Yeah. You know, when somebody has dementia and there are these issues of, you know, just what you described, or also, you know, issues of increased susceptibility to other forms of abuse, right, financial abuse. It's always a good idea to look into whether it makes sense to put this person under a conservatorship, right? And so what that is, for your listeners, a conservatorship is, it's a formal court process where you have to apply to the probate court to be this person's conservator, and a husband can do it for their wife. And in fact, that's the courts will see that as the most appropriate person, unless there is a reason not to see it that way. But it gives the person, number one, increased authority over the person with dementia to manage their affairs, right? So to manage their personal affairs, their doctor's appointments, their financial affairs. But it also subjects that person to court oversight. So what that means is the conservator has to check in with the court on a regular basis. They have to file reports with the court. They have to file accountings with the court. And so the court then becomes the responsible party in that scenario and not the conservator, right? So if the situation you described, the husband applied to be the conservator over his wife, over her person, you know, this scenario played out, the husband could then, you know, go to court and say, look, this is happening. You know, what do you advise that I do? I just want to let the court know that this is happening. And so the court would then, you know, be in a position to offer assistance.
We're going
to
be back with Josh Taylor. More elder abuse questions right after this short message. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Preferred Company with Joel and Mary Ann. And our guest this morning is Joshua Taylor, an attorney who specializes in elder abuse. Joshua, once again, welcome to Preferred Company.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Joshua, Mary Ann and I were talking during the break, and we brought up a scenario because we've both seen it, and I'm sure you've seen it hundreds of times. I've seen it myself in the agency that I am president of. People in their 80s remarry, and upon their demise, all of a sudden, stepchildren come in. They have never been there before and feel like they have claims to their parents' spouse. Have mm-hmm. you seen that throughout your career?
Sure. So a lot of what we deal with in the context of probate litigation tends to be trust and estate litigation, right? So that's litigation mm-hmm. over assets after somebody has passed away. Really what I can say is the best way to avoid that, the best way to avoid any type of probate litigation is to have a very well-drafted estate plan. And, uh-huh. you know, don't use LegalZoom.com. Go to an attorney, spend the money, because I can tell you, you know, the money that you spend on a good estate planning drafting attorney is well worth all the money that you would spend in legal fees in litigating something post-death. If you have a strong, well-drafted estate plan while somebody has capacity to execute such an estate plan, that includes, ideally that includes a trust where the main assets are titled in the name of the trust. So, you know, if there's real property that's titled in the name of the trust, bank accounts, investment accounts, all that stuff is a trust asset. Then, you know, upon the death of the settlers of the trust, all of that stuff can transfer to the trust beneficiaries outside of probate court. So, you know, not only does it give you some certainty that, you know, what you want to happen to your assets is going to happen after you die, but it also allows you to know that, your loved ones are not going to have to deal with the judicial process because all of this transfer will happen outside of court. Now, if you have assets that are outside of a trust, either that you own individually, that transfer pursuant to your will, or if you have simply no estate plan, then those assets have to be probated. So they have to, somebody has to open up the probate process by filing a petition with the probate court, and the probate court becomes the supervisor of the distribution of the assets. It's a lengthy process. And so to avoid all of that, you can simply have a trust and make sure all of your assets are titled in the name of the trust.
A woman has done estate planning. She remarries and lives happily with this new spouse who isn't even part of the estate. Mm-hmm. 5-6 years later, before she passes away, this man gets her to sign something that undoes, if there is such a word, the entire estate that was planned. Is there something in place that could prevent somebody from doing something at 5 to midnight?
So this goes back to our discussion about the diminished capacity, right? So if somebody has the capacity to understand what they're doing and they're not being, the legal term is unduly influenced by somebody else, they can do what they want with their assets. But those are really the two threshold questions, right? Number one, do they have the capacity? And, I can tell you I'm speaking from California law, but I would guess that there are similar standards nationwide. So in California, there are different levels of capacity that are necessary for the execution of different documents. So, for instance, there is a higher level of capacity needed in order for somebody to validly execute a trust because the law assumes that a trust is more complicated than a will. There is a lower level of capacity needed to execute a will. But that's the first threshold question, is does the person have sufficient mental capacity to be doing what they're doing? And oftentimes when you have people of advanced age where there may be some question as to their capacity, before executing anything, it's always safer to have them examined by, a physician or a mental health professional who can then attest to their capacity and actually, you know, be a witness post-death if there are questions to this person's capacity. So that's the first threshold question. The second is whether or not this person is being unduly influenced by somebody else. And so, you know, essentially that just means, are they being manipulated against their will to do something they wouldn't normally do? And so, you know, again, in California, there are certain presumptions, certain legal presumptions that certain factual scenarios are presumed to be undue influence. And what that does is it shifts the burden of proof to the other side to prove they weren't actually unduly influencing. So some of those presumptions apply when the drafter of a document is also a beneficiary of the document, right? So if I was to draft a will for somebody and make myself a beneficiary under the will, that will would be presumed to be not valid. Another presumption is when a caretaker or caregiver who is not related to the person who's making the gift, when that caregiver gets a gift under the will, that, you know, again, in California is presumed not to be valid because there's so many instances of caregiver abuse. There's actually a statute that specifically addresses that. And then, you know, generally there's a presumption that when two people have a close relationship and the influencer participates in the drafting of the document in some way. So maybe they take the other person to the attorney's office, or they schedule the appointment, or what have you. And there's some unfair outcome that you wouldn't expect based on the relationship, based on, you know, what you know about the parties. That's also presumed to be undue influence. So, you know, the law does provide for some safeguards in some of the most common scenarios. But, you know, the remedy for all of this is after the person dies and you look at their estate plan and what you're seeing doesn't make sense to you, you do have to file an action in probate court to invalidate these documents on the basis of undue influence or lack of capacity.
What could my mother do today so as to prevent this never happening, and is there such a thing?
And your mother, I'm assuming, has sufficient capacity at this point?
Absolutely.
Okay. What I would recommend is have your mother, does she have an existing estate plan?
Yes.
Okay. What you may want to do is ask her whether or not she wants, is she comfortable with her existing estate plan and whether or not she wants to make any changes. And the thing is, you have to be careful because you don't want to really participate in the process, right? Because you don't want to raise the inference that you're somehow unduly influencing your mother to make changes. So it's a fine line, but, you know, have her be the one to, you know, to make the decisions and to initiate contact with an attorney and all of that. And, you know, while maybe you can give her a ride to the attorney's office, don't sit in on a meeting with her. Have it be a one-on-one meeting with the attorney, just her and the attorney. And so, yeah, I mean, I would recommend her, you know, re-examining her estate plan, asking herself whether she's comfortable with that. The best case scenario for her is to have everything in a trust and to have likely her as the trustee, but to have a provision in the trust that says, if she loses capacity at any point in time or becomes, you know, in any way unable to manage her own affairs, that somebody else, maybe you, maybe another family member, is the person to take over as the trustee of her trust. And then number three, make sure everything she owns is owned by the trust. And that way, if down the line, God forbid, she, you know, she loses her capacity and she becomes susceptible to undue influence, all of her assets are owned by the trust. Somebody else is already the trustee. And so, you know, whoever's trying to get to her assets would have to go through that other person, which makes it much more difficult.
Is there a website that our listener friends can visit so that they can get more information about you and your firm?
Well, it's www.keystone-law.com.
The phone number, please.
Sure. 310-444-9060.
Joshua Taylor, Marianne, and I want to give you a big thank you for all the information that you offered this morning.